From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we take a walk around the rejuvenated Westlawn Gardens, a transformed public housing neighborhood on Milwaukee's northwest side.
Later, how practicing Buddhism helped Arnim Michaelis transform his life away from hate.
I think I could not have done this without some other kind of spiritual practice. Whether I'm praying or I'm meditating, I needed that device and that tool to cultivate and practice my own inner peace. Otherwise, there's no way I could do any of this work.
And for this month's Fit for You, can you guess what piece of exercise equipment was originally used for practical duties on the farm or in commerce?
Actually, they used it back in the day to weigh the dry goods, so the grains and all that, to help equalize and weigh it in the market.
You'll just have to keep listening to find out. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Throughout the month of May, neighborhoods around the country host events called Jane's Walks. The walks honor the work of the late Jane Jacobs, an advocate for the needs of everyday people in urban planning. The walks are citizen-led and are aimed at spurring conversations about the neighborhoods and the people who live in them.
10 years ago, it would have been unlikely to imagine a Jane's Walk happening in Westlawn Gardens. The public housing project was more than 50 years old and had long since passed its ideal as a vibrant community. But tomorrow, the revitalized Westlawn Gardens will host a Jane's Walk, in part to show the world what the neighborhood on Milwaukee's northwest side has become.
Namely, it's become a project that was recently honored with a National Planning Award from the American Institute of Architects. We got in a little early on the walking and met up recently with four people who have been involved in the community's rebirth.
Warren Jones with the Housing Authority.
Jackie Barrera, RIO President.
I'm Paul Williams, the Choice Neighborhood Coordinator.
Tom Beard, Mayor of the City of Milwaukee, and we're happy you're here.
So we're standing on Birch Street in the middle of the Westlawn Gardens development. Let me ask you a strange question as we stand here and look around. If we had been standing here 5-7 years ago, what was this neighborhood?
It was a public housing neighborhood with, in this particular area, 332 units of housing, ranging from duplexes all the way up to six unit buildings.
And they had been built when?
1952, right after the war.
And when you talk about a 1952 development that was thought of as a public housing project in those days, how did it or did it not meet the needs of what life in the 21st century is about?
Well, it was fine for 1952. The one thing that wasn't accounted for was accessibility. All of the bathrooms were on the second floor, so anybody utilizing a mobility assist device was really left out of the living in the units. The basements were constructed and perennially flooded. Just about every year they had a certain amount of flooding out here because of the water table that exists.
I think the other difference, it had very much of an institutional feel, very, very much a cookie-cutter approach, and that was what they did then. Now you come here, and this is a neighborhood, and that's part of the goal, is to break down the barriers between the people who live here and the people who live in the surrounding neighborhoods, so that you don't have this sense that you're entering a place that's different. And I think most people who would drive through here would be very, very surprised that this is actually public housing.
Jackie, was this your neighborhood before this was here?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. I used to stay at, when I first started out in Westlawn, I was at 6401 on 61st Street, and then I moved to the west side when I came back in 2005. And I miss it, I love it, and wouldn't trade it for the world.
Well, yeah, so talk about the before and after. What was here when you first came here and what you see around you now?
Okay, when I first was here, we was in public houses, and the houses was okay, but they weren't okay enough, like flooding and different other functions in the house. And now we have a lovely development, and I love it, appreciate it, and can't wait to get back. Right now I'm in Berryland, but I can't wait to get back to Westlawn.
Well, so we were going to take a walk to the park, and so let's do that. And we've got a stand here for people to work on their bikes.
Yeah, it's a bicycle repair station because there's an awful lot of children and young people that live in the development. And so we wanted to make something that if they didn't have the tools at home, they could come here and pump up their tires or repair something on their bike.
And these are, I mean, as I look around, there are different styles. There are some that are townhouses. There's some, this is kind of a bungalow here.
Right. It ranges everywhere from 2 to 5 bedrooms. So we really wanted to accommodate families of all sizes. We also have 2 multifamily buildings that are all single bedroom units.
Question for Mayor Barrett, actually. What did you see as the priority for this neighborhood, and what was the catalyst to get this project going?
Well, one of the things that I gained from was having experience in Congress, where I was very familiar with public housing as a member of Congress. I knew the challenges that other cities had experienced in having what I would call decent, respectable public housing. I also knew the leadership here in the city of Milwaukee was really committed to being innovative and cost-conscious in trying to be cutting edge, and they were very successful in doing that. So when I entered office, I thought that there's a great opportunity here to allow the Public Housing Authority to continue to run in a way that I felt was very creative. And they've had a lot of successes. We've had a few bumps in the road, there's no question about that. But overall, the direction has been extremely positive. And I want to have a positive neighborhood experience, and that's something that the Public Housing Authority here in the city of Milwaukee, I think, is really striving for as well.
Mitch, if you want to look to the south portion of the streets, those are bioswales, and what they do is they take the stormwater runoff off of the streets and hold it for a period of time so that we don't have the influx of water into our sewer system, which causes combined sewer overflows and, unfortunately, keeps it out of the basements and out of the lake.
And to describe it for people who aren't seeing it as we walk, there are kind of notches cut out in the curb that let runoff go into an indentation that sits between what some people call the boulevard between the sidewalk and the streets.
Right.
And that's where the water is being held.
Right. And it's really an engineered ditch is what we like to refer to it as, because although you see grass and plants on top, there's really an engineered fill underneath that will help retain and allow the water to evaporate at its natural rate. We have a series of healthy homes in this block that we're walking by right now. What that is all of the products on the interior portion of the home are non-fibrous. There's no carpet. The other thing that we utilize is a higher filtration rate on the furnaces, so that people that have asthma or other COPD-like illnesses can live here and not be subject to as many harmful inhalants. And the other thing I wanted to point out is this was the first neighborhood in the city that had LED streetlights. That was a prerequisite that we wanted to introduce. The Department of Public Works allowed us to put these in, and I think they were convinced, because I know they're using them in other neighborhoods now. So,
Mayor Barrett, is there a precedent that a neighborhood like this sets for both other public housing or even just neighborhood development around the city?
Well, I think there's a precedent that's being set here for both. Clearly, this is a model that we're using in other potential developments that the City of Milwaukee Housing Authority is going to be working on. But it sends a positive message, I think, throughout the city for all housing, that you can have sustainability as part of your mission. And as Warren was saying, it has an impact on our combined sewer system to make sure that we're both keeping the houses dry, but making sure that the lake doesn't have more discharges as well. So this is really, in many ways, a planned community in the most positive sense of the word, where you're dealing with a lot of different issues at the same time. And I think the fact that you've been able to incorporate so many quality of life aspects to really respectable housing is a real plus for everyone.
Jackie, it must be amazing to walk around and see what's here versus what you knew.
Yes, it is. It's amazing, you know, to bring your kids out and enjoy the park and the garden. And I have some other interesting things over there, like rocks and things for the past, our old resident, as well as the future. But we'll show them to you when we get over there.
All right.
Yes. But I enjoy it. I enjoy being in a garden over there every year. I enjoy it real good.
Well, tell me a little bit about the garden.
The garden is open to the community, and we get up, we clean it, and it's healthy. We do compost, dirt, and stuff like that for it. And residents enjoy getting out, planting their garden, tending to their garden, and picking their garden. They enjoy it 100%. Look forward for it every year.
Would you think that the people that are going to be living in West Lawn, as more of it is built, is there more of a sense of investment in the community around them, the desire to keep it as nice as it is?
Yes, it is, because a lot of residents, they is concerned about the community, and me as one, I do get out and patronize with the community, and they looking forward for, you know, when coming back as one and doing and keeping the development up.
How many kids do you have?
I have two biological. I adopted four. So I have six girls.
You have your hands full. Well, so let me ask, what does it mean to them growing up having a community around them like this?
They love it. My second daughter, the biological one, she was raised out in West Lawn. My third one, she's my niece, but she's my daughter. I adopted her. She was raised, and they love it. And my last three, they hated when we had to move, but they love the community. They love doing things like in the garden, the park, whatever they can do, they love it. They just love it out here. They love it and can't wait to get back here.
We currently are in a phase where we're filling in the empty lots on the east side. We're finishing up with 4 3-unit buildings. And these are modular homes that are brought to the site and then put up in less than a day. And we've got another two set of duplexes that are going on along Custer right now. They'll be coming in 2 weeks.
So these houses that we're seeing going up right now, they were not here a couple days ago?
That's correct. The last one was erected in 2.5 hours. So...
Pretty amazing.
that is amazing, but hopefully built to last.
Oh yes, they meet all of the building codes. As a matter of fact, I always like to say that they're actually stronger than site built because they have to be built to withstand travel down the highway and all kinds of wind loads that don't necessarily go with a stick built home.
Well, and I was wondering, as I'm looking at what's going on here, what's being built, and the thought that's gone into it. It just sounds like a completely different approach. I mean, obviously the people who designed the original West Lawn aren't here to defend themselves, but you know, there seem to be a lot of things that are given thought to today that in 1952 weren't given any thought to at all.
That's correct. In 1952, they were basically looking for the most affordable housing that could be built for people with low income, and just plopped it down in the middle of a farm field. This was really farm field when it was originally developed, and then the city kind of grew around it. And the idea now is make houses that anybody would like to live in, make them appealing, make them energy efficient, make them accessible, to really address everybody's needs, not just housing for low-income folks.
We're also seeing additional investments in the neighborhood as a result of the changes here. One of them is the new multi-sport court that the Milwaukee Bucks and Johnson Controls partnered on to have put an investment into a neighborhood. And so this brings a whole new kind of gathering space, a new community center, essentially, for people of all ages. And that happens to be built on top of a huge drainage cistern, holds about 800,000 gallons of water, again, which helps with our stormwater retention on site.
Everything is multi-purpose.
Right. That's trying to meet as many needs of the community all at once.
Mitch, one of the things that I wanted to point out, since we're down by the garden, is that Lincoln Creek is actually right adjacent to the West Lawn property, and we actually received a grant from the Friends of Lake Michigan to do this work. And you might ask, well, what does this have to do with Lake Michigan? Lincoln Creek flows into the Lake Michigan watershed, and by doing all of the things we did with stormwater retention as well as stormwater clarification, we've improved the clarity of Lincoln Creek. And as a matter of fact, some of our first residents were salmon that were swimming upstream. So,
remind me when this will all be a completed project.
Well, 2022 is when the Choice Neighborhoods grant is due, and by that time we will have all of the building completed and residents all moved back.
And when he's referring to the Choice Neighborhood grant, there really are two components to what's going on here at Westlawn. You've got the eastern portion, which you can see is nearing completion. A lot has been done here. This has been transformed. The western portion, where we were fortunate enough to receive about a $31 million federal grant to help us, we're going to leverage those dollars with private dollars, trying to get tax credits, other forms of capital to help us move forward to complete this. So in the 12-year period that this is going to be worked on, there's going to be an entire transformation of this part of the city in a way that I think most people driving through here would say, wow.
Obviously, the process for this started when there was a different political climate in Washington. Are funding mechanisms more challenging to come by as we stand here in 2018?
Well, fortunately, what has happened is that we got the award, and that's all systems go. So there may be challenges moving forward, depending on what the Congress and President's appetite is towards public housing. But for this one, we feel very confident that the pieces are in place. But I want to stress this again. I want people to see this neighborhood, to see that you can, a community can, a local government can do housing in a way that is really, really, I think, sensitive. And when I say sensitive, that it cares about people. And this is something that really shows that this is a real community.
So to think back on the days of the design charrettes and to see what's around and physical now has to be a fairly powerful feeling for everyone involved.
Absolutely. It has been such a transformation, and in such a quick amount of time as well. I mean, you see the great diversity in the housing styles, which are reflective of housing styles throughout the city of Milwaukee. It's almost as if the neighborhood was built over time because of the differing styles. And our goal long-term with the Choice Neighborhood Initiative is to use this as the foundation to impact the surrounding neighborhood as well. So in that effort, we're looking at surrounding retail. We're working with the school system to improve the schools in the neighborhood. To really create this continuum of high quality education from birth to college or career. We're working in some of the other public spaces in the area, some of the parks, to bring some new amenities or to highlight existing amenities like Havenwood State Forest, which is nearby. Really just a jewel of a green space. It's a refuge from city life. You can just walk through, you can see nature. Just reflect on life.
I was going to say we're only a couple blocks away from Silver Spring. Have there already been changes in the retail scene there, linked to the kind of rebirth of Westlawn?
We've seen improvements in some of the retail. There's some retail right across the street to the east of us. There have been some improvements. The House of Corned Beef, which is a favorite location in the neighborhood, just located into a new building. They have the Choice Neighborhood Initiative has supported facade work on that building. And we're looking at other ways to meet resident needs by working with the community. So looking to improve access to fresh food, a sit-down family restaurant, a banking institution, ATM, things like that are really important to a neighborhood.
So still a lot of work ahead.
There's a lot of work ahead, but we have many partners that we're working with, you know. And so now this gives us a push to really go over the top.
Paul Williams is the Choice Neighborhood Initiative Coordinator, and Warren Jones is the Vice President of Construction for the Housing Authority of the City of Milwaukee. Jackie Burrell is President of Westlawn Resident Council, and Tom Barrett is Mayor of Milwaukee.
You can see pictures and find a link to more information about tomorrow's Jane's Walk at Westlawn Gardens at WUWM.com.
Next on the program, we catch up with contributor Arno Michaelis about his memoir, My Life After Hate. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We spoke a few weeks ago with occasional Lake Effect contributor Arno Michaelis, along with Pardeep Singh Kalika, about their book, The Gift of Our Wounds, and their unlikely friendship that blossomed after the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek. But that's not the only recent book by Michaelis, a former white supremacist.
He's also the author of the memoir My Life After Hate, which looks back at, as he describes it, his former racist skinhead past and its roots. It examines his transformation from his central role in the white power movement of the 80s and 90s to his work today, which he terms waging peace. Michaelis is back in the studio with us. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much, Audrey. It's always awesome to be here and really looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. So I was going through your book, My Life After Hate, and oddly enough, but also helpful enough, was that it's a teacher's edition. So there's like writing prompts and discussion prompts and things like that. But I have to, you know, just for our listeners to know, I've known you only as you are today, as Arno Michaelis, the former neo-Nazi, the great, big, lovable guy who we talk about nerdy things with, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But this book was really my first look into the weight of what you used to be, you know, because there's some pretty graphic depictions of, you know, the street fights you used to get into or just your everyday reality.
Right.
And it's, you know, kind of transported me to the alternate universe of Arno, so to speak. So in your perspective, when you were beginning to write this, was it difficult to decide to be so candid in revealing your journey of what you used to be?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really my impetus to write the book was things that were going wrong in my life at the time, which was 2006, 2007. And it was actually like a really brutal heartbreak that I was going through. I had dated this woman for a little bit and I was like madly in love with her and it didn't work out. And I blame myself for that, and I blame my past. Like, I kind of felt like, where do I get off thinking that I'm going to go riding off into the sunset with a beautiful woman who loves me after all the harm that I'd done, after all the people that I had hurt? And I realized at that point I had to reconcile my past. I had to go there and face it with openness and honesty. And it also occurred to me that in the process of doing that, if I can help other people learn from my mistakes and hopefully not make them in the first place, then in this process of catharsis, I can also make the world a better place. And so that all was front and center as I wrote. And I knew that I had to go deep. Like, I had to go back to who I was, and I had to think and talk and act on the page the same way that I used to, with the language, with and not necessarily, like, cussing. I still cuss like a sailor. I got no problem with that. But it, like, with using racial slurs every other word, which nowadays, like, racial slurs hurt me because they dehumanize people that I love dearly. Very important people in my life. Back then, every other word was a racial slur. It was like just my bread and butter on a daily thing. So if I'm writing like that and I'm writing dialogue about how I used to talk, I have to be real. And it sucked to go back there. The chapters in that book that are steps back in time and glimpses of who I was and where I was were really difficult to write. And they're still very difficult for me to read. And I would say in the book, like, if I could barely write this, who's going to want to read it? And that occurs to me for sure. But I really, having read other people's memoirs, and I actually was immensely inspired by the autobiographies of Frederick Douglass, which he's just such a brilliant, was a brilliant man, and was such a brilliant writer. That kind of openness and honesty was a goal of mine, and that's where all that came from.
Looking back on it, there's the whole concept of violence versus thought, and obviously thought has overcome what used to be your very violent life. So how do you put yourself, so to say, like, in check every day? Because you admit you're still struggling with your anger. You still struggle with the things that you did and coming to terms with,
right?
Like you said before, like, how do I deserve this when I've done this?
Right.
So which is more difficult for you, the violence versus thought on that plane?
I started a meditation practice in 2009. And I took a formal refuge vow in 2014 saying, like, I am officially a Buddhist. My Tibetan name is Nyingchen Chosum, which means renunciation, Dharma bridge. Buddhism and the Dharma, which is the teachings of the Buddha, is a daily practice for me. And in the simplest sense, my interruption to the cycle of violence is just a breath. A meditation is just about noticing your breath and being engaged with it. And when our mind is focused on our breath for a split second, it's not worrying about the future. It's not regretting the past. It is absolutely present where we are here and now. And that's really what Buddhism is all about. And the power that breath has to interrupt violence is just immense. And I do still struggle with anger issues. For 25 years of my life, my response to conflict, it was instant violence. And so nowadays, you know, somebody cuts me off in traffic or whatever, like little innocuous offenses, I still get that, like, rush of, like, ugh! I want to put my fist in something. But instead, I take a breath and I feel that breath and I bring myself present to it. And when I come back, even nanoseconds later, now the violence, now the conflict, now the offense, whatever that is, has lost a lot of its power. And I can move on to other things, and I can have my mind available for what I want it for rather than what this external thing is trying to take over.
Do you think keeping up your new life goals and lifestyle would be possible had you not embraced Buddhism? You know, do you think you would have had to find some other structured outlet in order to not revert back to the habits?
Yeah, absolutely. The meditation for me is it empowers everything I do. And I don't think that I could have done it otherwise. Being a student of the Dharma and studying spirituality and being so fortunate to work with amazing Sikhs and Christians and Muslims and Jews and Hindus, you know, people of every spiritual background and people who are secular humanists, you see the common themes in all of those. And to me, really, it's a human need to be at peace with change, which I think is throughout the history of our species has always been a real challenge for people. And so all these ways have been whipped up to try to find that peace. And if from, you know, the three Abrahamic religions, it's faith in God and faith in God's will. And that just doesn't work for me personally. I've never been into, like, higher power stuff, supernatural things. But had I not found Buddhism, I think I could not have done this without some other kind of spiritual practice. Whether I'm praying or I'm meditating, I needed that device and that tool to cultivate and practice my own inner peace. Otherwise, there's no way I could do any of this work.
You mentioned we need to be at peace with change, but a large part of your life and part of the appeal of being a skinhead and in that group was that you gripped so fiercely to racist dogma or spin developed on facts. And in your book, you reference that, yes, these are technically facts that we used. And I'm curious, just with today's current climate of fake news and spin,
right,
and just the overemphasis of like what is fact, what is not fact, or this is a fact, but this is interpreted this way.
Right.
How do you view that today when it's coming from even more people and organizations and higher power, and it's not just a group of skinheads in an attic in River West?
Yeah, exactly. It's incredibly imposing nowadays. Back in our day, this was all pre-internet. So we would like have to find a physical piece of paper to like, show people and be like, look, this proves that the Jews are doing this, this, and that. And, you know, it proves all these paranoid conspiracy theories. Today, the same process happens. And I think the way to understand it all is to break it down that people are getting really upset or really passionate about things that they have zero firsthand experience of. And so when I'm talking to people today, whether it's, you know, someone who's in the Klan or someone who's in like far right political ideology or far left political ideology, I always go like, let's talk about you and your personal experience. What have you seen, felt with your own eyes in person? And let's talk about that. Set aside all this extraneous information for a minute. And again, this is Buddhism 101. We're bringing ourselves present. We're not sitting here stewing about something we read on Facebook this morning. Not that that information isn't valid, but I think we have to challenge ourselves to ask how much weight we're going to give it. And perception is reality. That was true in the Stone Age, it was true 1,000 years ago, and it's like triply true today. Our perception is kind of hyper amplified beyond where it ever has been. And I think personally, for the sake of my own inner peace, not that I don't take in for information from Facebook and things like that. It's part of living in today's society. But I always want to come back to my personal experience, present right now, this moment, what is going on in my life, what have I experienced, and we need to cultivate more of that, and it's incredibly difficult. There's the deck is stacked so against it, and there are people absolutely who are manipulating that for the sake of power.
You have a great passage in this book. This was obviously published and completed a few years back. Obama just won his first presidency. You write a great passage about your excitement to be part of, like, in that campaign of that first time.
Yep.
But then you also come to reflect on, okay, he's in office, but things haven't changed as, like,
right.
Everyone hoped that of the great fervor and passion for change that everyone had.
Right.
You know, and time has passed. He's had two terms. Now we have President Trump in office. So has your view of politicians changed or not changed? Or, you know, what concerns you the most with this current term? Because it's an even more of a juxtaposition, you know? And yet, as you say, you have to remain constant in centering things around your experience. But
exactly.
With your experience of having both extremes in your life, what's your view of it today?
I did a talk at the East London Mosque. It was the oldest mosque in London, and I had a great audience and amazing conversation afterwards. And one of the guys, you know, British Muslim guy who I'm talking to afterwards said, you know, you're so well-spoken and your ideas are great. Like, you should really get into politics. And I was like, dude, I thought you liked me. Why would you wish that upon me? I honestly, after 2008, it just really sunk into me that and it's not even just the American political landscape, it's politics anywhere, is just such a filthy, dirty game. And there's so much inertia, like heading in the wrong direction with stuff that is in motion. And there's so much inertia of an object at rest for things that should be in motion and that aren't. That it's really, it's discouraging to me on all kinds of levels. I personally will never get into politics because I think working with people face to face is the best, and cultivating things at a grassroots level. My work and especially everything I've learned from working with party, it's really about cultivating things like compassion and forgiveness and kindness in our society. And if our society can adopt those practices, the politics will take care of itself. I believe wholeheartedly that the government, as well as media, because both of these things get seen as like some kind of ominous alien external force that's manipulating people in our society. It is our society. The government is a reflection of our collective social consciousness. And if our collective social consciousness is dominated by fear and loathing, the government will reflect that, as will the media. If we want to change what the media does, if we want to change what the government does, we have to change ourselves first and foremost. Until we do that, the government and the media will reflect the strife that exists in our society because inner peace is so, it's such a rare thing nowadays. So, yeah, I'm discouraged by politics. At the same time, like, to quote President Obama, who I still absolutely love, he's my favorite president ever. I wish I could have voted for him again. But to quote him, like, don't boo, vote. And I would say also, like, yeah, marching, protesting, that's all great. But if you're doing that without voting, you're involved in romantic violence the same way I was as a skinhead. You're thinking that this immersing yourself in this conflict and just getting all whipped up and enamored of the fight, of the conflict, of the thrill that of adrenaline that you get, whether you're in a street fight or you're in a march and you're getting sprayed by cops with pepper spray, if you're doing that without voting, I think it makes things worse.
That's a great lead into my next question, which I have a quote from your book where it says, every day was a rally when you were a skinhead. So I'm curious, what's your everyday for you now?
That's a great question. Every day is still a rally for me.
<It's>, just a different kind.
Exactly. I think about cognitive dissonance a lot, the human tendency to spin information to suit our preconceived notions. And when you hear the term cognitive dissonance, it's typically someone accusing someone else of suffering from it. And that's interesting to me because I think every single human being on Earth suffers from cognitive dissonance. And if we can convince ourselves that my political team or whatever, my way of thinking is the lone way of not – that's free from cognitive dissonance, that's the ultimate cognitive dissonance. Being at peace with cognitive dissonance, it lets understand that our mind is spinning reality to suit some preconceived notion, and then let's ask ourselves what preconceived notion do we want to be our lens. So for me, that preconceived notion is compassion. It's forgiveness. It's love. It's kindness. And it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of challenge to look at the world through that lens on an ongoing basis, especially in times of political strife, especially in times when white supremacy, systemic racism, these very real social illnesses are still causing so much damage. But those lenses of love and forgiveness and kindness and gratitude are all – that's the antidote. That's the cure for those things. And that's why my rally every day is – not giving up faith in humanity and not giving up faith in the basic goodness of our collective human experience. And yes, it absolutely takes an immense amount of energy. So that's why you got to be rallying for it every day.
Arno Michaelis is an occasional Lake Effect contributor and author of the memoir, My Life After Hate. You'll find more information, more of this interview, and you can listen to his award-winning essay for this show at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then our Fit For You segment picks up a kettlebell and helps us understand why many other people are picking up kettlebells as well. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. From ropes to tires, the fitness world has found ways to repurpose old work tools in the name of exercise. One of those tools you might be seeing more of in your weight room or health club is the kettlebell. What's actually been around for centuries is just now becoming a standard piece of fitness equipment for group exercise and personal training.
But why is the cannonball with a handle any better than your average dumbbell? For this month's Fit For You, we traveled to Experience Fitness in Hales Corners for a group kettlebell class with instructor Kelly Bullard. She begins by explaining the kettlebell's history.
Well, the funny thing is, it's actually been around for many years. A lot of credit comes from the Russians with using the kettlebell. Actually, they used it back in the day to weigh the dry goods, so the grains and all that, to help equalize and weigh it in the market. And then who knows what happened with that as it started to evolve. And there's history with the Greeks and with the Chinese also having similar apparatus as well. But of course, in the recent years, we use it as a form of fitness, and that's more or less what it's used for now.
Now, I understand it's been used in weightlifting competitions for quite some time. So when did the advent of kettlebell classes start coming to go beyond the weightlifting community?
Well, that's a good question. There's actually, there's not an exact date for that. But in recent years, you're going to see a lot more in the fitness industry with kettlebells incorporated into Group X classes and even personal training.
Now, with the kettlebell, I imagine there's a combination of obviously strength training, but what does it do for cardiovascular endurance, flexibility, anything for a whole body experience? Because someone who looks at it isn't necessarily going to know what to do besides pick it up off the ground.
Right. It's much more than just a piece of dead weight. You actually have dynamic resistance, so you are getting a lot of muscle endurance and a lot of cardiovascular at the same time. You have multiple muscle groups working together, so it's not just one body part, but multiple parts working together.
How is its mass and weight distribution ideal for certain exercises? You mentioned dynamic movement. So how is it utilized for that?
So there's many different ways that you can hold the kettlebell. You can hold it from the base. You can hold it from the horns, you know, the handle. And it offsets the center of the balance of the apparatus. So it depends on the movement. If it's a swing or if it's a figure eight or if you hold it, you can do a squat press. So it gives a little bit of a different type of movement pattern, engaging different muscles. And one of the biggest things you're going to engage is the core.
Last two. Now, guys, if you want to go up a side, you're going to go back to some triceps. You can stay like you want. You have triceps and biceps, so
compared to a regular dumbbell we may see and pick up and stand still and just lift. This has a lot of instability, but in a good way, that unstable force that you're resisting against. So what exercises and body movements are these typically used for? Can you explain, you know, any of the basic movements that are most common?
Sure. There's some classic movements that you will find. The kettlebell swing is one of the most common, and it's a great movement that will really activate muscles, say, on the backside of the body, your gluteals, your hamstrings, your lower back. Sometimes you'll have also physical therapists using the kettlebell as a way for rehab and therapy. But we use it in a group fitness class and in kettlebell class to strengthen up the backside. Then maybe you will have a figure eight, which is, with a squat, passing the kettlebell between the legs, grabbing the hands and standing up, you know, alternating each side. So now you're getting the squat involved. You're getting the core involved, the glutes. It's a lot of great things. So the kettlebell brings together multiple body parts, upper body, the lower body. So it's really, you can use one kettlebell or you can have two kettlebells.
And I imagine with incorporating different body parts all at once, the importance of having a strong core and also just proper form is incredibly important.
Yeah, proper form is necessary. Good spinal alignment, engaging the core, protect the spine. Also to make sure that you have a balance of muscle groups, because you don't want to focus too much on one body part. So, you know, if it's the glutes that are working, that's great. Then you work the front side of the body. If it's the upper back, make sure you work the chest and so forth. But with using the dynamic motion, you do engage multiple body parts. So it creates more of a balance, not to mention the cardio burn that you have.
You mentioned they used it to weigh and distribute things just in the marketplace or whatever else, and that it mimics, okay, here's what we do to work on the farm, here's how we lift things. So is this also, do you think, a more holistic approach in strength training and building endurance because we're not standing, lifting, or we're not seated at a pulley system, pushing, pressing?
Yeah, definitely. It's a lot of functional training, because in weightlifting, we might have one plane of motion going on at a time. In this, we're working the three different planes of motion and getting different movement patterns that are realistic to life. We don't move in just unilateral patterns. We actually move in multi-dimensions, and kettlebell is very functional in that way to strengthen the body.
Now, with a kettlebell class and exercise, how is it typically formulated? Is it heavy repetition, or is it going from each exercise, say hold it for a minute and move on, how is it structured that it can help the muscles in the most effective way?
All right, well, there's many different ways to format a class. So you could go higher higher weight and less repetitions for more muscle building and strength and power. We do actually high repetitions and lower weight because we're dealing with the general population, so we want to everybody to be able to do something. So we have kettlebells that range from 5 pounds all the way up to 25 pounds that we use. And most of the time, everyone grabs different sizes, maybe two different or three different sizes of kettlebells, depending on the exercise. So if it's muscle isolation, something for the triceps that's not dynamic, for example, they might go a little bit lighter versus something for the kettlebell swing, you'd want to go heavier because those are larger muscle groups.
Do you think this is more beneficial than typical weightlifting of that static movement, having this class to do it?
There's definitely benefits for both. I really like the kettlebell format in forms that we bring in the cardiovascular, we bring in muscle resistance, we bring in you have flexibility through movement. So you have gains in everything, but there is a lot of research that documents the calorie burn for kettlebell classes. We do keep our kettlebell classes here short at 30 minutes, and really you get a scorching calorie burn. You're sweating when you're done, even at 30 minutes.
What kind of audience do you get for your classes here? And is kettlebell, you know, a good way that can be modified for people? Many people might be intimidated and not even know what to do, but what would you say to encourage them to give it a try?
I would tell you that everybody can do something. So we have everybody. We have younger, we have older, we have men, we have women, we have unfit, we have fit. We have everybody, and we have people that, you know, love fitness. We have people that don't love fitness, but they come because they love the class and they love the benefits that they get. And really, in 30 minutes of your life of a 24-hour segment, there's really not that much commitment. And they come in and some do this class only, and then some will stay for maybe another class, you know, for the day. So it's a great opportunity for everybody to come in and do something.
How should a novice person progress with kettlebells? What is a safe way to do that? And what are some good basic moves for anyone listening that they can walk over to a kettlebell stand at the gym and practice something on their own before, say, jumping into a class?
I would definitely recommend that they start light in the kettlebell size. So if I have a first timer come to class, I welcome them and suggest that they start maybe with a 5 or 10 pound kettlebells just so that they get the correct form and the alignment, and let them know that, you know, once they feel that that's good and I can help give them some feedback too, you know, and help them become stronger with good form, then they can go up in kettlebell size. But because of the high repetitions, we don't use very heavy kettlebell sizes right away. And that's what I would suggest for people, is not to go too big too fast, is really work on good form and alignment first as priority, and then they can increase the size.
With alignment, I imagine it differs from picking up a kettlebell in between your legs to holding one above your head. And because it's just that one horn grip, the center of gravity of the kettlebell is different. So how does that affect how you need to be aware of your body?
Yeah, there's a few key features that we really need to make sure is that the core is engaged, keeping the spinal alignment, even up to the neck, the head and the neck, making sure that's aligned with the spine as well, regardless of the move. If you bend over for a squat, you know, not to make sure that you hunch forward or arch your back, you know, whatever the movement will be, we need to make sure that our form is good and that we're doing dynamic movement, so we need to make sure that everything is perfectly aligned.
What can it offer people? You mentioned there's cardiovascular endurance, calorie burns, much more, but functional. Have you seen improved mobility in any age group that you see come through? The cardio, the strength, obviously, but does it also offer a mental component?
Oh, definitely. It's something different. You know, some people maybe have gone to the gym. They might stand on the treadmill. They might go lift a few weights. But having a group fitness setting, really, it's like having a life coach with you, with a group of people to motivate you. So mentality-wise, you're more motivated as, you know, you allow yourself to push through. The music that we use is there, not necessarily to a beat. It's there for the background to motivate. And I try to keep current with the trendy music and what's going on, that stuff that's going to motivate people to work out and, you know, for people to come in and focus on their form and their movements just for 30 minutes. It's a nice escape from life, too.
You are an instructor of many hats. This is not your only format that you do. So what does teaching, and even before teaching, learning how to properly have kettlebells as a strength tool, well, how has it benefited you?
I love the 30-minute format that we offer. And I like how diverse it is. I actually do teach many different formats, as you mentioned, and I've been doing this also for about 4.5 years. But I like to pull in different aspects, such as HIIT training. So we might put the kettlebell down and do some high intensity for maybe a brief moment, followed with some active recovery. But with that short bout to get the heart rate up, it also increases your calorie burn and also your calorie burn after the workout.
Have you noticed that it helps you with your endurance in teaching all these different formats, that the strength you gain from here translates over?
Oh, definitely. And I would say not just the strength, but also it's going to be the endurance as well. So you'll notice, you know, the legs are very engaged, the abdominals, the core. So it's not just the strength, but also how long your muscles can really work and the lack of fatigue then that you feel as you continue to get stronger.
Since gyms are just now starting to have kettlebells on their weight floor as a standard equipment for people to use, classes are not yet totally available or as popular as, say, other fitness formats. So what would you suggest to someone who's looking and interested in taking the next step besides playing around with it on the weight floor?
I would definitely suggest for them to check out, see if their gyms or their facilities offer kettlebell classes. Usually personal trainers have some experience in training with kettlebells as well, so maybe they can get coached on their form and the exercises and then go ahead and start doing some on their own as well.
What would you say to anyone who's perhaps going to be looking in the door here but not quite coming in? What would you say to encourage them to give kettlebells a try?
I would welcome them in and let them know that, hey, we have everybody that comes to class and everybody can do something. So start light. We'll give you a lighter kettlebell, so get you started. I usually keep an eye on the newbies as well to help them, coach them along, and everybody can do it.
All right, Kelly. Well, I'm excited to try this. Thanks for speaking with me about it today.
Thank you for giving it a shot.
Kelly Bullard is a fitness instructor who led a group kettlebell class at Experience Fitness in Hales Corners. We spoke with her for this month's Fit for You, and you can listen back to previous installments in the series at WUWM.com. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow on the show, we talk small-scale manufacturing in Milwaukee and how it shapes the area's economy, plus an in-studio performance from singer-songwriter Caitlin Canty.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. Enjoy the carol of the kettlebells, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.